Welcome. It was Gershom Scholem, the great 20th century scholar who many credit with single-handedly having created the field, the academic study, the field of the academic study of Jewish mysticism. It was Gershom Scholem, that great genius and profound scholar, who succinctly summarized the Theosophical Kabbalah's worldview by telling us that according to the Zohar, quote, God, the universe, and the human soul do not live separate lives, each on its own plane. The Zohar's point of view of all of reality, from the innermost depths of God's being to the most external reaches of the physical universe, all these are layers within layers, all conjoined in one continuous, unbroken system. This is the view of the Zohar. This is the worldview which Scholem described for us and defined, that these things, God and the universe and the human soul, are all interconnected. They are all structurally parallel, all reflecting each other. God, the macrocosm, the general principle of all reality, recapitulates himself, itself, on all layers. All of the microcosms, all of the small things around us, from the human being to a candle to a book, to the universe as a whole, all recapitulate this structure of God's inner being, the realm of 10 sphirot, 10 divine potencies emanating from the depths of God's own unknowable essence, the Ein Sof, that dimension of God, the unconscious depth which is unknown to us, unrevealed, and according to Nachmanides, never once mentioned in the Bible because of its obscurity and unknowability. All things, according to Scholem, are interrelated in one unified, continuous system. God, the universe, and the soul do not live separate lives, each on its own plane. Their lives are interdependent and codependent, because in being related to one another, almost as if they were in physical contact with one another, whatever touches one part of the system ripples throughout the entirety of the system. And this leads to the most profound and most audacious implication of all of the Kabbalah. Because all things are interrelated, whatever happens at one point in the system affects all other points in the system. The universe was created, the physical universe, the ordinary world in which we live, was created as a result of inner workings within God's realm. But once the universe was created, and there is now a human being, a body and a soul, what that body and soul do have a reciprocal effect on the entire system of God and the universe. Being interconnected, what happens in one place causes effects in all the other places. And this is the profound and audacious principle of theurgy, according to which the Kabbalists believed that whatever we do here has an effect and implications for what is there. What happens on the outer affects the inner. What happens in the inner affects the outer. This interrelatedness, structurally and substantially and dynamically and reciprocally, forces a major division in opinion between the philosophic tradition of Judaism and the Kabbalistic one. The philosophers believed that God was totally transcendent and totally self-sufficient, that nothing that ever happened on earth could affect God's deep structures, that the universe was dependent on God, but in God's own self-sufficiency, nothing that happened here could affect the divine. Religion, in the philosophic view, was therefore not something done for God's benefit, but it was God's gift to human beings in order to give them guidance on how to live. It really theoretically doesn't make any difference to God what human beings do, because God would still be God even if there were no human beings on the planet Earth. The principle of self-sufficiency, which the philosophers again and again drove home, is what helped the Kabbalists crystallize their own notion that the philosophers were quite wrong. One suspects that if the philosophers hadn't been so intent on saying that human behavior has no effect on the divine realm, that the Kabbalists themselves would never have pushed so far their notions of the human effect of the effect of human behavior on God's own realm, the principle of theurgy. For the philosophers, God is self-sufficient. For the mystics, God is totally dependent on human beings and on their behavior, in particular on the behavior of the Jewish people, the people who are in possession of the true secrets of the structure of the universe and who hold the supernal mysteries, knowing how God's inner life is reflected in the life down here. For the philosophers, religion is according to human need. For the mystics, for the Kabbalists of the Zohar, reaching back to the Bahir, religion is a divine need, a supernal need, a tzorech gavoha, that what is done here is done for the sake of God. It is radically theocentric. We already talked about a passage from the Bahir in reference to the notion of transmigration of the souls. You'll recall that what the passage in the Bahir said was that depending on whether the people of Israel are good or bad, that's what will determine whether souls are fresh or recycled ones. That what will energize and activate the divine system, the process of gathering or sowing in the East or mixing in the West, whether a new soul will come into the world or whether one will be recycled, is entirely contingent on human behavior. And that is already a hint at the profound principle of theurgy. What human beings do determine what processes will be activated in the divine realm. An example from the Zohar of the effect of human behavior on the divine realm. It was traditional in Jewish life to have three meals on the Sabbath, one in the evening, one in the midday, and one in late afternoon. According to the Kabbalah, there was a divine good reason for having these three meals, to celebrate the Sabbath and to enjoy it. As the Zohar puts it, from the activity of three meals, it follows that the three meals of the day are necessary not for ourselves alone. It's not just for human enjoyment, relaxation, and nourishment. These three meals of the day are necessary not for ourselves alone, but for all of creation. For in such a way is fulfilled the true faith in the Holy Ancient One and the various three stages within God's life that are reflected in these three meals. This is an extraordinarily audacious claim of what the significance of human behavior is. Meals on the Sabbath are not just for our enjoyment, but the Zohar teaches us, in line with the Kabbalah, that all of creation, including God, in some way is dependent on and enjoys the benefits of these three meals. The Bahir gave another example of how human behavior affects what happens with the spherotic realm, these potencies within God's being. And it played on the Hebrew word for sacrifices, interpreting what the sacrificial cult meant in antiquity. The Hebrew word for sacrifice is korban, which etymologically is related to the word karov or likarev, meaning to bring things close. That what a sacrifice does is bringing things together. And what was brought together in the act of sacrifice, according to the Bahir, were these various potencies within God, who in some sense were separated from one another and not interacting. But as a result and a consequence of the bringing of sacrifices on earth, the bringing of korban, the close-making thing, the various sphirot were joined together and interacted with one another. More concretely, it would be the act of coming together as the prince returned to his bride's chamber, bringing to her the treasures which he had taken from his father's house. Conjoining, bringing together, forcing interaction is what the korban does. Likharev, it brings into proximity things which are separated. And this becomes the great goal of the Kabbalists, to perpetuate the unity or to affect the unity, if it's been broken, of God's inner life and the unity of God's inner life with the external world, in much the same way that the soul must be coordinated with the body in order to govern its affairs properly, so too must God be brought together with itself and with the universe in order to maintain good order. So these are old, old ideas in the Kabbalah, certainly surfacing in the Bahir, but reaching prominence in the Book of the Zohar, the 13th century classic. I thought it would be a good idea to take a close look at one very audacious and very powerful set of images developed by the Zohar to convey its idea of what human behavior means for the divine realm. We return to that, I keep coming back and back to it, because I think the Zohar and the Kabbalists were also attracted to it, but in its own right it's also attractive. The Song of Songs, again, a mystical interpretation of passages from the Song of Songs, which the rabbis had taught all Jews to read as an allegorical statement of the loving relationship between God and the people. The lovers of the Song of Songs in rabbinic literature were not just human beings of flesh and blood, but they were allegories for God in Israel. Inheriting this idea, the Zohar took it the next step further, reading all parts of the Bible as indications, hints, of God's inner life. The lover and the beloved of the Song of Songs in the Kabbalah's point of view is a story of happenings within God's inner life, much in the way that our dreams are read by psychoanalysts as stories depicting events and processes going on within our own soul. The verses from the Song of Songs that the Zohar interprets come from chapter 1. I am black, but beautiful, O daughters of Jerusalem. Do not look upon me, for I am black. Shechara ani v'na'ava. I am black, but beautiful, daughters of Jerusalem. Do not look upon me, for I am black. The Zohar continues, speaking of the woman, who we understand to be the name of one of the divine potencies, the feminine within God. When she is feeling great love for her beloved, and in the Zohar's vocabulary, we're talking about a process going on within God. When the feminine within God is feeling great love for her beloved, the masculine forces within the divine, because of the straining need for love, which she is unable to bear, she reduces herself to such a small size that all that remains of her is the smallness of one letter, namely Yud. The Hebrew letter Yud, Y, a little dot, a line, an iota, is the first letter of God's four-lettered name, Yud, He, Vav, He, the so-called tetragrammaton. And following good Kabbalistic practice, the Zohar reads the shape and the placement of letters as allusions to God's being. So there is a symbolic name for God's feminine, which is Yud, a very, very small dot above the line, an iota. When God's feminine potency is in a state of overwhelming love and need for her beloved, she reduces herself in size, becoming, symbolically, the smallest possible letter in the Hebrew alphabet, a Yud, an iota. That's all she is, the first letter of God's name, without the other three. Thereupon, after reducing herself in size to the letter Yud, one little line, she immediately hides herself from all her hosts and regiments, saying, I am black, for in this letter there is none of the whiteness which exists in the other letters. If I were to transpose this into English, what the Zohar is trying to convey is the difference in shape between, let's say, the letter L, which is just one black line with no interior space, which is white. It's just one black line. In contrast to the letter L, or I, would be a letter like B, which has black lines that enclose white space. The Hebrew letter Yud, according to the Zohar, is the only one that has no interior white space. It's just one plain dot, the letter Yud. And like that passage we read in an earlier lecture about the maiden hiding herself, the maiden being the Torah, the feminine in this passage hides herself without any white space at all in the smallest possible, almost invisible Hebrew letter, Yud. And she does this because of her overwhelming passion and need for her lover, saying, I am black, which is an extraordinarily literal reading of the verse in the Song of Songs. I am black, daughters of Jerusalem. Why does God call herself black in this sense? Because she's become the letter Yud, nothing but a black dot line. Therefore, she says, do not look upon me. Do not gaze upon me at all, since I am merely a minuscule point. Well, when she obscures herself and hides herself in the form of letter Yud because of her overwhelming love, what do her surrounding hosts, what does her court do? What do her companions do? What do her champions and regiments do? Because queens in these medieval chivalric tales always have knights and soldiers and armies and champions around her. What do they do? She's obscured herself and reduced herself to a minuscule point. But they roar like powerful lions, making an awful lot of noise. Roaring like lions, the sound wafts through the divine realm. And listening above to the sounds and mighty roars of the beloveds, of the lover's champions, the lover, the masculine within God, has a signal, knowing that his beloved is as much in love with him as he is in love with her. So much so that neither her iconic image nor her beauty is visible. Again, the Zohar loves to luxuriate in paradoxical formulations. She is so filled with love for her lover that she reduces herself and makes herself almost invisible, disappears. Very paradoxical. We would expect exactly the opposite, but the feminine within God being extraordinarily modest and perhaps knowing how to invite further attentions, she reduces herself in size. She becomes invisible. Then her lover, with the help of the sounds of the roaring lions of her champions and the roars uttered by her hosts, the beloved lover goes forth from his palace, laden with gifts and offerings, with perfumes and spices, coming upon her and finding her black and minuscule. Here again the imagery recapitulates the imagery that we found in the Bahir of the prince and his bride. In this passage in the Zohar, the prince comes laden with gifts and treasures, with perfume and all sorts of gifts and spices, coming upon her, finding her black and minuscule, without any iconic image and beauty, reduced. He approaches her, embraces and kisses her, until she is slowly aroused by the perfumes and spices. I remind you that on the obvious conventional level, this language sounds like the language of ordinary human love, about what a knight after his maiden, pursuing his maiden might do. But in the Zohar's understanding, this is a tale not about earthly goings-on, but about divine goings-on. It's audacious, unapologetic, romantic, chivalric imagery. He comes to her, the masculine within God, the feminine, being embraced, kissing her until she is slowly aroused by the perfumes and spices. And with the joy she experiences in the company of her lover, she is built up and restored to her original stature, restored to her ornaments, her iconic image, and her beauty, becoming the letter He as in the beginning. The Hebrew letter He being the second letter of the four-letter tetragrammaton of God's name, Yud being the first, the dot. He being a very large Hebrew letter, with a lot of open space, it's almost a rectangle. She enlarges herself, becoming the letter He, restoring herself to her beauty. So now we have the transformation of the letter Yud into the letter He, which is the Zohar symbolic way of saying that the feminine within God has now been aroused and engorged with love, filling with passion, and with the joy brought by her lover's gifts and perfumes, she's restored to her full beauty and size. But the Zohar is not interested only in the upper world, because the upper world is connected to the lower world, and what happens there happens down here too. And so the Zohar characteristically shifts attention from the romantic going on within the divine realm, the sacred marriage, the hieros gamos, where the masculine within God comes to the feminine and seduces her, bringing her gifts and bringing her to full life. The Zohar shifts attention from a divine process to something going on down here in the world. Similarly, in the lower world, the world that you and I live in, when there are evil ones in a generation, she hides herself, reducing herself until the only thing visible of her iconic image is a single point, which is the Zohar's enthusiastic way of saying that there are two reasons why the feminine within God would reduce herself. One would be a purely internal thing. Because of her love for the masculine within God, she would be reduced. The second cause for the reduction of the divine feminine to a single point would be if people on earth are evil. Because of their evil actions, she rehides herself. God retreats from the world, as it were, when people perform evil deeds. Disappearing, hiding, caused to go into hiding because of the evil deeds of people in an evil generation. Reducing herself until the only thing visible of her iconic image is a single point. God becomes the letter Yud, almost evacuated from the universe, almost disappeared. But if evil human beings can cause God to reduce herself and hide, then good people ought to be able to do the reverse. Just as in the first case of God's masculine coming to the feminine and filling her with life and love and beauty again, so too if good people on earth do the proper deeds, then God will be restored to its, her, his total fullness, in the Zohar's language. But when the truly righteous appear, they make this word, as it were. The word being referred to here in the Zohar, what the good people, the righteous people do, make the word, is a way of saying making the word of God's name, transforming the Yud into the He, building the word up. And in building the word up, we symbolically understand what the Zohar means by restoring God to his fullness. When the truly righteous appear, they make this word, to paraphrase it, they make God, as it were. And she, referring now to God, slowly begins to glow, her iconic image and beauty being restored, a He, as at the beginning. Originally God in her, his, its, fullness, God was a He. Human behavior caused God to be reduced, almost becoming invisible, disappearing. But if human beings behave properly, perform the law properly, with the right intention, intending to fulfill the needs of the whole universe, as on the Sabbath when the three meals are eaten and enjoyed, not for human benefit alone, but for the sake of the Holy One, blessed be He, the masculine within God, and for the sake of the Shekhinah, the feminine within God, then those three Sabbath meals have the profound theurgic effect of restoring God to His fullness. The bringing together of the masculine and the feminine, and the filling up of the entire world with the divine presence. That is exactly what the Zohar means. As above, so below. As below, so above. Making love in the proper way of performing Jewish rituals is a way of making God. That is the theurgic idea of the Kabbalah. It transformed the entirety of Jewish practice, cultic law, religious law, family law, observance of the holidays. All of these observances now took on a divine referentiality. Just as the words of the Torah, or the words of rabbinic worship, were seen to have layers and layers of meaning, that they were seen as allusions, symbolic names for the divine depths, for the layer upon layer within God, so now the same procedure is applied to human action. And human action is seen as having layer upon layer of significance. Eating the three meals on Sabbath certainly fulfills some obvious external physical needs. It certainly is a fulfillment of the law, doing what people are required to do. But this act, too, has increased layers of significance and importance. The significance reaches all the way through creation, all the way through the depths of God. Poetically rendered in the Zohar, in the analogy or the metaphor, the figure of the feminine within God being rejoined with the masculine, the Yud becoming a He. All human behavior now has as much of an infinity of significance as the words in the Bible had an infinity of significance, referring to ordinary things, divine things, supernal things, and things in Jewish history. Ordinary events and supernal events. Words became multiple in meaning. Jewish actions became multiple in significance. To sin was to cause great harm, not just to human beings, because they had done evil and needed to be punished, but it would also cause great harm in the divine realm. As a 16th century Kabbalist, Rabbi Moses Cordovero, put it in his compendium of mystical lore, the meaning of the Hebrew term teshuvah, repentance, which literally means turning toward. The significance of the word teshuvah is that everything is in the hands of man. Everything is in the hands of the human being. Everything is in the hands of human beings. Human life, universal life, and God's life. The existence of exile, the state in which the Jews were living in the Middle Ages, according to Cordovero, certainly had something to do with socio-political events on the planet Earth. But to a Kabbalist, if the people were in exile, it's because they had done something to interrupt the proper flow of divine life. They had kept the feminine separated from the masculine. They had forgotten that the ten sefirot of God's life are unified, conjoined one within the other. They had sinned. So exile, having to do with human behavior, proves that all things are dependent one on the other, and that everything is in the powers and the hands of man. According to Cordovero, man is the cause of cosmic and divine catastrophe. For as he puts it, formulating the Kabbalah's point of view, sin blemishes and darkens the light of the Sefirot. But when the penitent, the person who does teshuvah, when the repenting person does teshuvah, that will strengthen the light, repair and bring light. And that is the secret meaning of repentance. not merely undoing what human beings have done as sin and asking for forgiveness, not only correcting human behavior, but correcting the very divine world itself, bringing light again to the Sefirot. Theurgy, then, is closely connected to the Kabbalistic understanding of what evil is all about. Evil causes a rupture or an interruption or a darkening, not only of human life, but of the divine life as well. Good deeds, or the struggle against evil, is keeping things in good repair, keeping the divine lights luminescent, spreading light to one another, and bringing light into the world. To do evil is to darken the light. To do good is to bring the light to light. If it only were a matter of understanding the mysteries of the Bible, and if only it were a matter of understanding the mysteries and significance of human behavior, everybody would be a Kabbalist. The question would have to be, what were they up against? Why was it so hard to do good? Why was it so difficult to perform properly one's responsibilities? One didn't have to be a Kabbalist to understand that human life is a life of conflict between good impulses and bad impulses. When it all comes down to the bottom line, the Kabbalah understood that human beings have power because they have a choice. A choice between doing good for themselves, the universe, and God, since all three are interconnected, or by bringing harm to themselves, to the universe, and God, by doing evil. The question would have to be, why did God create the world with evil in it? Why are there temptations to do wrong? Why must the impulse to do wrong be overcome? Why isn't that the most natural thing to do? The Kabbalah understands the presence of evil in the world in the way that most garden variety religious people would understand it. And it's in accordance with its principle that all is for the greater good. This is the best of all possible worlds. Had God, from a completely non-Kabbalistic point of view, created human beings without evil impulse, then there wouldn't be any reward and punishment. There wouldn't be any moral stature. People couldn't become what they could become. We would have no impulse. According to an old rabbinic legend, if there were no evil impulse in the world, chickens would lay no eggs and no houses would ever get built. We are prompted by our desires to accomplish stuff, and that stuff that we accomplish is necessary for life. God needed to put evil into the world in order to keep things going. Or to use the Zohar's other analogy, it might not be the best thing in the world, but there's no other choice. If you have wine, it must be put in a container. If it were not for the bottle and the stopper, what would happen to perfume? The bottle, the substance, the heavy material that preserves the wine or the perfume is not of any use in itself, except for its protection of the perfume within. And this would be the basic Jewish understanding absorbed by the Kabbalists for why there would be evil, the temptation to do wrong. It's built into the system. Without the impulse to do evil, there would be no moral life. The Kabbalists, however, go further. And they say that if human beings and the world were created without evil impulses, they would in some way be deficient because they wouldn't reflect something within the divine realm itself. That in some profound way, if God is the origin of all things, then God must be the origin of evil as well. There is evil above, and there is evil beneath. Evil, therefore, is an ordained and acceptable, all for the greater good, part of human reality. The Zohar tells a wonderful parable about this justification for evil impulse in the world. It's the parable of a king who had a son, and the son apparently was very well behaved, never did any evil, never succumbed to temptation, and the king was very proud of his son's purity. But one day the king began to think, perhaps my son is only good, because he's never been subjected to temptation, and therefore he's not true and tried and tested. I'd better find out what he's really made of, what his moral fiber is. So the king invites a beautiful woman, a courtesan, into the court and instructs her to do everything that he can to seduce. She should do everything that she can to seduce his son. She tries every trick in the trade that she knows, but she's unable to tempt the son into committing a sin. The king, realizing what his son is made of, having resisted the allures of the courtesan, is filled with joy. He releases prisoners from jail. He declares a holiday in the kingdom. And he hugs his son, embraces him, filled with joy, now reassured that the son is really a truly good person, because subjected to temptation, the son overcame it. The Zohar then pulls away from the parable of the courtesan, the king, and the son, and it makes its point explicit. Who is to be credited for bringing joy to the king? Who's to be credited with bringing a party to the whole kingdom? Who is the one who obeyed the king and brought joy everywhere, reassuring the king that the son was good? Was it not the courtesan? Was it not the woman who was hired to seduce, to trick the person into sin? She deserves all of the credit. Again, the Zohar favors paradoxical or ironic or unexpected ways of putting its ideas. You wouldn't think that in ordinary religious discourse, a courtesan would be found to be much of a hero or a heroine. But in the Zohar's paradoxical way of enjoying the playing with figures and metaphors and poetic images, the courtesan is given all of the credit. And who is the courtesan? Who is it that God hired to try to seduce us and asks us to resist? It is the evil inclination. The evil inclination which must be recognized as an obedient servant of God's kingdom. Evil must be given its due. That's the way God needed to create the universe, and it is as rightful an existing thing in the world as anything else is. Evil is a divine creation as well. And evil must be credited with the same divine source as everything else. To deny that evil has its proper place in the universe would be as silly as to deny that wine needs a jug to be contained, or a river needs riverbeds to channel its power, or that musical ideas need mathematically defined musical notes and rhythms in order to give expression to the inspiration. Things need to be contained, need to be defined in the mainstream Kabbalistic view, and evil is, in a sense, a function of limits. It sets the law, the border. This you may do, this you may not do. It is a rightful thing in the universe and needs to be recognized as such. According to the Zohar's way of reading the book of Job, Job's great sin, paradoxically, was in his refusal to recognize the rightful place of evil in God's creation. As the book of Job puts it, once upon a time in the land of Uz, there was a man named Job who was totally just and upright, Vesur Meirah, turning away from evil. In the ordinary way of reading that verse, you would think that it's a compliment to Job to say that he turned away from evil. But in the Kabbalistic view, to turn away from evil means not to recognize and credit evil with its rightful place in the universe, denying that it too has its functions, that it too is an obedient servant of God's will. Job was too much of a goody-goody. He refused to acknowledge that evil is a real power, that it derives directly from God in the way that all other things do, and in denying the integral part of evil in creation, Job caused a separation in reality by saying there is the divine realm, and then there is an undivine realm called evil. splitting and making asunder what the Kabbalists understand needs to be conjoined together in one interlocked system. By turning away from evil, Job denied the true unity of God's all-inclusive existence and on the rightful place of evil in reality. Evil in that sense is benevolent. And theurgy then is the set of behaviors which knows how to calibrate what good must be done and what evil must be credited with, or how evil must be served or recognized in order to keep all things in balance. Another of the metaphors that the Zohar uses for evil are the serpents and monsters that a king would use to surround and protect the treasure. Because those who really are afraid and don't know how to reach the king's treasure will be put off by the serpents and monsters of evil which the king has put to protect the treasure. But those who truly understand what evil is will not be afraid of the poisonous serpents and monsters which the king has put in his treasure chest. They will be able to pacify the evil by doing what evil needs in order to get to the treasure. Those who are small-minded and small-souled, who don't recognize evil for what it is, will never get to the king's treasure. Evil is an integral part of the universe. When all is kept within bounds, as long as human beings do what they're supposed to do and the Jews observe the law with proper intention, then they maintain the full iconic status and beauty of the divine. They maintain the conjoined union of the masculine and the feminine. They bring joy to human life and throughout the universe and through God's realm itself. If they do evil, however, and darken the lights of the Sefirot, they bring catastrophe not only to God, but they bring it to human life and to the universe as well. Evil must be kept in its proper place. Once evil goes beyond its proper place, once it is allowed to do more than seduce and to be resisted, then the lights are darkened and catastrophe follows. For the Kabbalists before 1492, for the optimism of the Zohar which believed that all was created for the greater good, and that truly speaking, evil is not absolutely evil, but a necessary part of the universe, human behavior could maintain all things. Evil was a necessary byproduct of creation. You can't have an omelet unless you crack the egg. You can't have human life or the universe without the containers from which evil derives its force. But once we allow evil more than its proper due, once we succumb to the temptations of the courtesan, then the stakes grow higher and the lights of the Sefirot are darkened. These are the necessary consequences of the world being created in the way that God did, according to the Zohar. It's in our control how much will happen of good and how much will happen of bad. But this is the way it was intended, and it's all in our hands. It's manageable if we behave and observe. Evil is a byproduct of creation in the way that the afterbirth and placenta is the necessary consequence and complement to new life. The way that iron, when it's forged, creates slag. The way iron, when it's forged, is you find the dregs floating on the surface. You can't have reality without placentas and afterbirths. You can't have life without garbage. You can't have wine without dregs, iron ore without slag. That's the way the universe should be, and it's all for the greater good. After 1492, Jewish mystics and the Jewish community in general was not so convinced that evil was such a byproduct of God's creation. Thank you.